Coffee House Shots is sponsored by NatWest Group, principal banking partner of the Global Climate Change Summit, COP26, in Glasgow later this year. NatWest is helping its customers reduce their carbon emissions by joining forces with organisations like Microsoft, identifying energy-saving methods for small and medium enterprises. Find out more about their approach to climate change at natwestgroup.com.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Kate Andrews and James Forsyth. We've had a lot about the South African variant, but today we've heard some positive news in the sense that a trial has found the Pfizer vaccine is 100% effective against the South African variant. James, do you think this is going to change the government's attitude towards variants? Because up until now, when we're talking about easing things, there's a big component, which is the fact they worry about virus evading variants.
I don't think it will radically change the government's attitude towards variants. First of all, our vaccine programme so far is fairly evenly split between Pfizer and AstraZeneca. And the AstraZeneca vaccine, the studies suggest, is less effective against South African variant in stopping people from getting mildly ill. The scientists involved in devising the Oxford vaccine are pretty confident that it would prevent you from getting seriously ill. But I mean, you need to find more evidence on that. I also think the government's big concern is not any of the known mutations that are out there right now, but that one might come along that does evade the vaccine. And I think that is the concern. Now, I can hear listeners saying, you know, how you can't base your entire policy around a hypothetical situation. But I mean that they would think that the fact that the Oxford vaccine is less effective in terms of reducing infection with the South African variant would suggest that, you know, there could be a variant of the virus that could evade the vaccines.
But we're still waiting for, I suppose, more thorough studies.
More thorough studies, indeed. And I think that, you know, I think also if you look at the amount of money the government put into the development of mRNA vaccine manufacturing, I mean, these are the vaccines that you can tweak the most quickly to deal with a new variant. I mean, that suggests that they do envisage having to update vaccine shots as being a feature of the next 2 to 3 to maybe 4 years.
Kate, can you talk us through that Pfizer study?
Really extraordinary findings, really positive stuff. Looking at their phase 3 trial, which had over 46,000 participants, and they were looking at people who, between 7 days and 6 months after the second dose of the vaccine, what was happening to them. And they found that there was a 91.3% efficacy rate for the vaccine. Really high headline figure, but the even better data is that they found that it was 100% effective against preventing against severe disease and death, and also 100% effective in preventing against the South African variant. A few things to note, it was still a relatively small sample size, about 800 people, and they found that of the few people who did get infected with the South African variant, they were in the placebo group. Nobody who had been vaccinated got it. And so people will be looking for bigger studies, as James was alluding to, but this early indication is still really positive because it suggests that the vaccine is robust against this variant. And I think it has two big implications for policy in the UK. First of all, it would suggest that its effectiveness is extremely good, and that's great news because it was the most vulnerable and the most elderly who were getting the Pfizer vaccine and who have gotten the Pfizer vaccine for the most part, because it was the first one approved in the UK and rolled out in December. It would suggest that they have a really good level of protection. And I think to this point about hypothetical variants, whilst anything could happen in the hypothetical, the South African variant was being ramped up for months as a really good example of how we could undermine the efforts here in the UK to tackle the virus, how we could undermine the vaccine. That Pfizer has shown so far to be robust to it, I think does have implications for future policy, hopefully leaning towards getting us back to normal and removing COVID restrictions. We don't know what the next variant may be or what will be said about it, but there was a lot of scary rhetoric around the South African variant and what it could do to vaccines, and Pfizer, at least so far, is suggesting that it holds up.
Now, in other news, James, yesterday we talked about the government's race report, and today we have had the news that Boris Johnson's senior advisor on ethnic minorities is to stand down. Various accounts coming forward with implications that this has something to do with that report, which has clearly stoked quite a lot of controversy, but has been kicked back from number 10. So what should we read from it?
I think that we know that this advisor almost resigned earlier in the year over a spat between Kemi Badenoch and a journalist from the HuffPost. There was a kind of sense that the government was overly interested in picking fights and having arguments. And I think this is, in some ways, I think there is a pity here, which is this report, right? I mean, everything is being dominated by rows about a poorly drafted sentence about slavery here, without which I think comes without sufficient explanation or context. When actually I think that the point it is making is, I think, a very important one, which is the frame of looking at Britain through a lens of there's a white population and there's a BAME population doesn't really help you, because different ethnic groups in Britain face different challenges, and the interaction of ethnicity and class and geography is very important. I think one of the big problems that we have in this country is we import American arguments about race when our racial situation is very different. I think it's quite telling that what kicked off this review were protests that began in response to the killing of a black man by American police officers. And I think that the American racial situation is very different from the UK one and isn't actually a particularly helpful prism through which to look at it. As we discussed yesterday, I mean, the sensible place to get to is that there has been huge progress made in this country on addressing the issues of racism and prejudice in society. I mean, this country is clearly a less racist place than it was 50 years ago, 30 years ago, even 5 years ago. But that doesn't mean that all the problems have been solved by a long shot, and is concentrating on dealing with those remaining problems while acknowledging the progress that has been made is, I think, the right balance to try and strike.
Kate, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I know that this is what happens in politics, but I think with this report in particular, it was a mistake for the government to release what it wanted the headlines to be a while before anybody could actually read the report. Because if you looked at those headlines and then you actually went and dug into the report, I think you get two very different pictures. The report itself is far more nuanced. And rather than saying that there's no structural racism, I think actually a lot of the recommendations point to the fact that there is some. I mean, the first recommendation is to challenge racist and discriminatory actions. It highlights the disproportionate effect of stop and search on different communities. So I think if you actually get into the nuance of it, you have something far more thoughtful than what the headlines and the debate ended up being. And I think James is very right to point to sort of the import of certain American ideas in the way that it feeds into this discussion. I remember last summer watching the protests exploding across the world in relation to George Floyd, and I actually thought it was quite right that the world was showing solidarity with what happened in America. But also, America is very particular on this, not just because of the history, but still because of certain laws, especially around policing. That means that police officers simply aren't held to account. So I think it can be a real mistake to sort of pick up what's happening in America and transplant that debate to what's happening here. But unfortunately, I think even in this particular case, once again, it did.
Now, finally, vaccine passports are moving up the news agenda. We have a Bank Holiday Monday special due, with the government due to release its preliminary findings on the issue. And before we get there, we've had an interview from Keir Starmer in which he's spoken about vaccine passports and suggested that the use of vaccine passports to decide whether people can enter pubs would go against the British instinct. But yet, James, in this interview, he doesn't necessarily say he is opposing it. And since then, we've had Labour sources suggesting that he may oppose it in several months once the vaccination programme is fully complete. So what should we read from this?
So I think one of Keir Starmer's skills as an opposition politician is looking at the situation, working out what the government is going to do next. And I think where he is right in his analysis, which he leaves himself ample wiggle room to support in the Telegraph column, is that the government will end up using vaccine passports or COVID status certification as essentially a bridging measure. In 2 years' time, we will not be, except maybe to travel abroad, flashing our vaccine passports to get in and out of places. While as this summer, while you're in a situation where you haven't given the entire population a second dose, all that jazz, then they might be required for large events. You know,
do you think to get into a large event, you need to have both your doses?
I think this is an interesting question, which would be one of the things that would be fascinating to see in the report because
a lot of nonagenarians going out there.
Yeah, no, but also because I think it's interesting because most of the studies, as Kate was saying on Spectator TV, as episode going out tonight, it's not that you shouldn't have your second dose, but the bulk of the protection comes from your first dose, both in terms of protection for yourself and in terms of protection for others in terms of not transmitting it. I mean, I think, for example, the famous example of a nightclub. I think a nightclub where everyone had had their first dose of a COVID vaccine with current COVID levels, I think is a relatively, it's not, that wouldn't be an irresponsible thing to open up.
Kate, also, if we were talking about nightclubs, and perhaps if we entertain the idea you could need two doses of your vaccine in order to go to a nightclub, I mean, the nightclubs might have to change their typical clientele, at least in the coming summer, given quite a lot of 20-year-olds aren't convinced they're going to have it anytime soon in terms of supply. 5 p.m. special. So how do you think businesses are going to deal with that? I mean, we're going to hear what Michael Gove is looking towards, but the strong implication from MPs who've been in these listening exercises with him is that vaccine passports are coming, but you could need things such as a negative test, so you're not discriminated against in order to get in.
I think it's going to be extremely difficult to put the burden on businesses to be checking somebody's vaccine or negative COVID test status as they're trying to enter the premises. I mean, indication at the moment is that a lot of hospitality anyway does not want this. They do not want the burden of having to do this. It's going to prove very difficult. There are a lot of really big outstanding questions as to how they could actually pull this off. If the people who are most likely to be going out and partying are the ones who haven't had their vaccine, the idea that you might need a negative COVID test within the past 72 hours is going to put extreme demand on the testing system. And I think it also, it raises broader philosophical points about really how much health information you should be handing over to a landlord or a premise if you want to go into their establishment, but also whether or not it's legitimate when you have a country that is very happy to take up the vaccine and that has already been widely vaccinated but will be even more so by the time we hit summer. If this is really necessary, if you want to bring in this framework, because of course once the government establishes a framework, it very rarely disappears, and under what context might they want to bring it back? So I think it's telling that even though Starmer did not fully commit to being opposed to them, he gave himself a lot of wiggle room. This is one of the first times that you've got the Labour Party, the Liberal Democrats, actively pushing back on a conservative government that wants to increase its power. And you could see, certainly, as the data is really strong right now, if it continues to look strong with infections, hospitalizations, death all plummeting from the peak, and the levels of antibodies in people rising because of the vaccine, I think it becomes increasingly difficult to make this argument that we would bring in basically the beginnings of a biosecurity state.
Now, also in the interview, we had Keir Starmer's dream dinner party guests. We had Thierry Henry, Nelson Mandela, Jacinda Ardern, Barack Obama, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and his wife. So while I have you here, I thought I would discover who your dream dinner party guests were. They can be living, they can have now passed away. Kate?
Okay, I haven't given loads of thought to this. Obviously, I would...
I mean, rule of six, so the world's your oyster.
Right, exactly. Obviously, I'd invite both of you. I'd love to have James and Katie.
It's a slight way seeing as we see each other every
at
day.
At my dinner party. I'm just saying, I think you'd be a delightful addition. I don't know, you need a bit of comedy, so I'm going to go for Lucille Ball. And you need a bit of intelligent, thoughtfulness, good writer. Virginia Woolf, my favorite writer. I mean, obviously the best president we never had, Mitt Romney. And in America, to be clear, not in the UK. I don't know. Move to James. I have to think of my last person.
So I think Keir Starmer, I agree with him. I would invite my wife too.
I'm sorry, you're not going to invite Katie and me.
Oh no, I think I slightly agree with KB that
all right,
this
no,
is
offense taken.
Yeah.
All right.
So I think I'd invite Herodotus as the greatest storyteller of all time. I think you can't. If you can go all through history, you can't miss the chance to hear Cicero speak. I've always thought that if I could have lived in any point in history, I think that Boston in the 1770s would be right up there. The amazing moment when basically a group of friends decide to take on the most powerful empire in the world and win. So I think I would invite Abigail Adams to talk about what life was there like there. Then I think, given that the way in which it has so shaped the 20th century, I think you invite Gertrude Bell, British explorer who did much to kind of set the boundaries of the modern day Middle East. And I think just because I would love to see the battle to talk between Herodotus, Cicero, and Winston Churchill. I mean, you know, I think you wouldn't be short on storytellers, raconteurs, and I think that should work quite well as an evening.
And any thoughts on what you'd serve them or?
I think you've got to have. I mean, you surely have to have kind of. I mean, the question is whether, in honour of Cicero, one should eat in the kind of Roman style, kind of lounging on couches.
Vegetarian.
But yeah, I think you'd have to have some Paul Roger champagne in honour of both the Spectator and Winston Churchill. And then I think you have to go for a kind of proper kind of roast lamb and, you know, mint sauce in the works.
Oh my gosh, that sounds great. I wish I were invited.
To be fair, of all the guests to be kicked out, I feel that this is what I'm going to be least offended by in terms of the status of the guests there. With that, Kate, unless you want to chip in your final guest.
Oh, uninvite me.
Sorry, I was way too distracted by James's extremely well thought out answers. I'm going to say that's open. Look, get in touch, listeners, if you want to come to my dinner party. I appreciate that James put a little more thought into his, but I'm not going to be at James's. So
we're going to leave that there. Thank you, James. Thank you, Kate. And thank you for listening.